Boy, I bet there are myths and folklore stories in every crevice all around this planet. And when we take phone calls, maybe you can share a few with us. I'll be back in a moment with Charles Cassidy as we talk more about Great Lakes folklore and his other works, Paranormal Great Lakes and Paranormal Mississippi River, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Charles Cassidy Jr. with us. And Charles, when you wrote the book, Paranormal Mississippi River, what did you, how did you key in on the Mississippi River all of a sudden?
That was the publisher's suggestion. I suppose working down after the Great Lakes, the Mississippi River is the next logical choice.
Next.
Yes, and I'd felt empowered enough that, okay, if I felt I'd sort of covered one waterfront, I will cover this one too. But let me ask you a question.
Sure.
You have an advantage over me. You have both. You have lived on the Great Lakes, and you have also lived in St. Louis,
The Mississippi. Matter of fact,
fine Mississippi River town. To your mind, which environment had more going on that was of a paranormal, strange, mystic nature?
I would say the St. Louis region did, Charles. You know, they have up the Alton, Illinois area. They've got the mystery of the Piesaw bird. Native Americans talked about this incredible bird that the chief had to fight to kill off before it killed him.
Right, and distinct from the Thunderbird traditions that sort of grew out of those fossil bones, this one seems more like a real, could have been a real animal.
Right, and a huge one. They've got a picture of it up there on the bluffs. In 93, we had a flood where the Mississippi just swelled, and it was just huge. I mean, it engulfed buildings and businesses, and they eventually put up one of those 500-year flood dikes, and they rebuilt the area, and I'm telling you, it's dangerous because they spent billions of dollars building new businesses in there, and if you know, those levees ever go, look out.
Yeah,
that whole region's going to go. But I mean, but St. Louis was always, I think, mired in old-time stories and traditions. So I can see where, you know, the Mississippi River would be something that you would capture.
Because my extremely unscientific experiment just came out thusly. Paranormal Mississippi River is physically about twice as thick a book as Paranormal Great Lakes. And so that was not my intention when I set out, but I ended up with such a wealth of material, albeit half of it being New Orleans in Louisiana, a unique city all in itself in the realm of amazing superstition, folklore, and just plain marvels, as I say, weakness for marvels. So, yes, proceeded to compile everything I could find that was fantastic and strange regarding communities along the Mississippi River. Everything from the mild werewolf and black dog problem they have in the Wisconsin, all the way down to Baton Rouge and the pirate John Lafitte is still occasionally putting in an appearance now and then.
I like the cover for the Paranormal Mississippi River. I mean, you've got the strange-looking creatures, strange people. You've got what looks like a gargoyle on the roof there.
Oh, yes. We pressured and enlightened terrified readers that, yes, I did draw my own covers for two of my books. I found myself, I worked immense, very cheaply, and it was much easier to draw these creatures than to actually get them posed for photographs. The cover of Great Lakes Folklore has been described as my most beautiful book cover. I cannot take credit for that. A gentleman named Paul Wunderly went to the Upper Peninsula and came out with a fantastic image. People are buying it strictly for that shade of red on the Keeper's Cottage.
I'm going to ask you what your favorite story is on each of your books. We went through a couple of them with the Great Lakes Folklore, but how about the Paranormal Mississippi? What stands out for you?
You know, not long ago, I was at a paranormal expo, and a young lady, two charming Kentucky women came up to me, a young lady and her mother. She had done her master's thesis, if I recall correctly, on the voodoo queen Marie Laveau. who, of course, is a major entry in Paranormal Mississippi River. And I thought, oh, I'm up against some real critics here. So I proceeded to, like, bounce stories off her that I compiled in Paranormal Mississippi River to see how many of them she'd heard of. She'd known of all of them, even Jenny, the river monster. Jenny, the river monster of the Genesee River in roughly the Kentucky area of the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. Finally, I came across one story she had never heard of, and it's the tale of Goat Castle in Mississippi, something in the Natchez area. Natchez, Mississippi, is a wonderful place also for just bigger-than-life stories. Goat Castle, you read this thing and you wonder, where is the Johnny Cash ballad about this place, or the William Faulkner novel? Essentially, there are these two neighboring plantations in the 1930s. One is inhabited by a demented, crippled, would-be piano player and his caregiver, who started out as his girlfriend but now more or less has legal custodianship of him. Their plantation is a wreck. They allow their livestock, particularly a herd of goats, just to live inside the plantation home and chew on Jefferson Davis's old antique collection and everything. It's an eyesore. Right across from Goat Castle is another plantation that is owned by a former friend of theirs. I'm looking down her.
What's that?
I'm trying to find the name. It wasn't Oliver Dockery.
That's okay.
In any case, Jenny Merrill. Jenny Merrill was their ex-friend. She tried to actually take possession of Glenwood, this dilapidated mansion, simply to raise it to the ground. She hated the sight of it so much, but was unable to by legal means. In 1932, Jenny Merrill was found dead, shot with a .32 caliber handgun, and immediately the inhabitants of Glenwood, this poor Dick Dana, the piano player, and his girlfriend are arrested. It then transpires, at least it seems to, that a third party, a roving bandit named George Pearls, was the one who shot Jenny Merrill dead during a botched robbery attempt. So the two inhabitants of this Goat Castle are freed, and they make the most of their exoneration by giving public tours of their ruined mansion. You can go online now to this day, and you can see the photos of it that were taken and for the newspapers and the newsreels of this this just horrible place where they just slept on the rain came in through the roof. They slept on straw mats, and of course goats were everywhere chewing everything.
Sounds like my place.
And the paranormal aspect of this weird story begins even before. Before Dick Dana and Octavia Dockery, she was his guardian. Even before their deaths, there are rumors that their late neighbor Jenny Merrill is now haunting the adjacent woods, shrieking that they did murder her somehow.
Jeez.
They murdered her and pinned it on this guy Pearls.
Do people see her? Do they see the ghost?
Yes, they see something, allegedly. Again, this is the folklore part of it.
Yeah.
That sometimes they see a vindictive old woman, sometimes they see a beautiful young woman who's taken to be Jenny Merrill at simply different stages in her life. And by 1958, I think, the Glenwood Plantation was finally bulldozed to the ground. All the players in this weird story are dead by now. However, Glenwood, the mansion that Jenny Merrill inhabited, is still standing, and you do get tales of voices heard in the night calling the owner's name. Classic poltergeist and ghost symptoms like light bulbs burning out in strange numbers, things going wrong with the electricity. One of Jenny Merrill's eccentricities was that she refused to have the home wired when she lived in it. So it's a very strange story of neighbors falling out, former friends turning against each other, and again, a murder that may or may not have been solved. Just like I say, there's a ballad in this somewhere.
And then with Paranormal Great Lakes, you've somehow expanded, I think, the region for these kind of stories. How does Paranormal Great Lakes differ from Great Lakes folklore?
It is more strictly covers the runs the gamut, basically UFOs, assorted so-called vortexes, triangles. More than one writer has tried to sort of relocate a mini Bermuda Triangle type affair to the Great Lakes. I think I counted up to about four or five of them, and I enumerate those. And another thing about the I should explain about both these books, I chose to present them in the form of A to Z encyclopedias.
Yeah, you did, and you did a great job doing that, by the way, Charles.
I felt, first of all, I was sort of treading in territory that other writers have before me, and I had to do something unique. And secondly, I wanted to represent them as perhaps a slightly tongue-in-cheek, as handbooks for the adventurous traveler. You're there on the Great Lakes or the Mississippi River. Phantom ship is bearing down on you. You've got to radio the Coast Guard with a full description and the registration number. Well, it's alphabetized there. You can go straight to my phantom ship section and hopefully get the information out before you meet your certain doom.
There were two myth folklore stories that I'll always remember. One, as a teenager in Detroit, they always used to talk about this Lover's Lane story, and it creeped everybody out. And a couple was in this Lover's Lane area, and it was probably all over the country, but it made it sound like it was in Detroit. So it scared the heck out of all of us kids. And they were listening to the radio, and a news bulletin popped in that, a killer was on the loose, and he only had one arm, a hook on his arm. You know, please be careful, da 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 da. And so the couple got all scared, and they drove away, and they went home. When they got out of the car, they saw the hook attached to the car door. So this guy apparently was ready to break in, and they drove off and pulled the hook right out of his hand or his arm section. That was a folklore story. There was another bizarre one, same thing, Lover's Lane. I guess they wanted to keep us out of there as kids. But they talked about how a couple, they were in their car, and he tried to start it up, and the car wouldn't start. He was out of gas or something. And he told his girlfriend, lock the doors, and I'm going to go into town and get some gas, and I'll be right back. And so she fell asleep. She wakes up and sees him hanging dead from a tree limb, and she screams, only to see the face of the murderer holding up the car keys. And so how would you categorize that, as folklore or as a myth?
Well, obviously those are both classic, patented by Jan Harald Brundtland urban legends.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say folklore, possibly. Again, when people who are professionals in the field who have studied folklore and compiled, I must say, some very good ghost story books in the process, they have these things cross-indexed and the motifs listed alphabetically in a much, much more rigorously academic way than my books do with these stories. It took me years to figure out, maybe you all knew this, the band name The Grateful Dead.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That is a folk motif. The Grateful Dead is from folklore anthropology. You do a favor for some tramp. You see that the homeless man receives a decent burial, and later his spirit returns the favor somehow, even just to appear and say thank you. That is what The Grateful Dead means. And in fact, I say there's nothing paranormal about my life, but that story has been told on my father's side of the family, that that when a kindly great-grandmother did exactly that for an indigent man in her district, and then the one night unearthly light poured into her room, and a booming voice just said thank you very much, and that was the classic Grateful Dead story.
Well, I would call
that folklore. Sure.
Did you ever hear of the one where if your car is on a railroad track, it will get pushed off the railroad track because there was a little boy who died in a railroad accident, and if you put talcum powder on your bumper, you'll see little kid handprints on it.
Oh, yes, I cover that in Cleveland Ghosts.
Is that in Cleveland Ghosts?
Okay. Yeah, lots of things are in Cleveland Ghosts that you will find, hey, wait a minute, that's in my neighborhood, no matter where you're listening, Connecticut, Oregon.
You're right.
Yes, these stories get out and become localized. The Crybaby Bridge, I have to tell you one, if there's time, that your show turned me on to in Paranormal Great Lakes. Another one of my favorites, you talk about Lover's Lane stories, Durand Eastman Park in Rochester, New York, mm-hmm. where there is, of course, the White Lady, also known as the Lady in White,
yeah.
Constantly looking for her, searching for her daughter who was murdered.
They did a movie on that, didn't they?
The movie, I'm sure, was inspired partially by it, but it did not tap into the really rich detail of the original folklore story, okay. which is that if you're a girl and you have doubts about your boyfriend, you bring him to Durand Eastman Park, and the White Lady will give him the scare of his life, and he will confess everything he's done wrong.
Oh, wow.
And that is a nice piece of filigree. And as I do note, putting on my reporter's hat, the case, the allegations have been thoroughly investigated. There's been no sign that there ever was such a woman in real life who lived in the Rochester area, who lost a daughter that way, and can continue to the story. She committed suicide jumping into Lake Ontario, and. No, it is a pure myth, but such a beautiful one, and so rich in its detail that I'm just charmed by it. It probably
that's a great story,
and it probably goes all the way back to in Hispanic and old Spanish folklore, La Llorona. Is that how I pronounce it? Probably a variation on her. And she has been traced all the way back to a couple of Aztec goddesses, if you care to go there.
Well, and it's amazing, too, Charles, how the story, the myth, somehow changes as more and more people talk about it. And they massage it into their own direction. Do these kind of stories pop up a lot around the Halloween time period, too?
Oh, inevitably, yes. And I find... When it's convenient for the motion picture entertainment industry, strangely enough, it's sarcastic there. I was on the job in my, movie reviewer phase when I couldn't help noticing that in every town it seemed if there was a street named Elm Street, suddenly it had a haunted, it had a local spook house located on it, and of course. None of that tradition existed prior to 1984. 1984 being when the first Nightmare on Elm Street movie came out.
Scared the living daylights out of people, didn't it?
And Freddy Krueger, I think, kind of became the Slender Man of his day, that a lot of impressionable young people sort of took to him, adopted him, and made that, thanks to that vibe, which is purely fictitious, now the name Elm Street is now forever tainted and will be the resident equivalent of Transylvania.
All right. Well, you stick with us. We're going to come back with more stories, Charles. And next hour, we'll take phone calls from folks who either have a question for you or a story of myths and folklore. I'm George Norrie. We will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to take your phone calls and stories next hour with Charles Cassidy. Then we'll have open lines later on tonight. We're going to come back in a moment and talk more about his work, Great Lakes Folklore, Paranormal Great Lakes, Cleveland Ghosts, you name it. We've got it, Paranormal Mississippi River as well. Welcome back, Charles Cassidy Jr. with us. Charles, what are you working on next? It seems like you never stop.
When I think that I've written about four books in 6 years, I do wonder what happened. And then I remembered, oh yes, the bottom dropped out of the newspaper industry. That's what happened.
That's right. Yes.
It was just to a degree a matter of channeling my exercises. For those who are overly concerned, I do continue to publish movie reviews online at the ClevelandMovieBlog.com. I'm grateful to a local man, Bob Ignazio, for starting that up. But in answer to your question, my next book is to be about Ohio UFO traditions. I do, both in Paranormal Mississippi River and Paranormal Great Lakes, I address our UFO concerns around here, and some very fantastic stories, too. I'm sure I don't have to tell you about the Highland Flying Triangle.
Great stuff.
You were probably on, there in St. Louis when it happened,
yep.
If I'm not mistaken. Incredible, yes, amazing sighting.
Are you going to highlight it all about Wright-Patterson out there in Dayton?
Oh, yes, indeed. I cannot promise that they will let me in and show me the whatever they've got. Well, one story about Wright-Patterson that I don't think enough people appreciate. For many years, whatever they had on ice there in terms of the visitors from afar, they also stored old movies, very old movies on volatile nitrate film. From the silent era and early sound era. This was chemistry that the film industry used in the old days, and if, unless stored properly, they could literally go off like hand grenades.
Yeah, and no, you're right. You're right. I remember my old news days where, you know, they developed the film the same way.
Yes, so that's why when Kodak made safety film, the young people listening don't even know what we're talking about. Film, you know, they just know
yeah.
Memory chips.
Film.
But
what's that?
Yes, yeah,
16 millimeter, 35.
But Kodak labeled their film safety film because it would not go up in a ball of flame and kill you. And so Wright-Patterson's vaults were used to store a lot of this dangerous film, during which I assume it was laboriously copied to safety film. And so there is much history there. Much throughout the state, I'm just discovering the Kecksburg object fell in Pennsylvania.
Great story.
Yes, but it passed over a good portion of Ohio. Bits dropped off of it, set some fires, and I even know some folks over there in Lorain who were insisted that part of it crashed there, and they saw a few strange things in the woods. So I am looking forward to them embarking on that. Oh, and of course, we can't forget our Mothman and the fact that the very first Men in Black movie was made in Ohio. Nobody knows that.
Oh, really? How about that? That's cool.
Yes, it is called The Men in Black. Watch the pronoun, The Men in Black. It is a 16 millimeter, very accurate, little Twilight Zone type depiction of a man just being hounded to his demise by men in black who may or may not be. It's very strongly indicated, in fact, that they're just figments of his imagination. He's off his meds, but it nails the paranoia and the phenomenon in a way that the Will Smith Tommy Lee Jones movies just threw out the window to be a farcical adventure.
Have you concluded anything yourself about these UFOs?
It's not one single thing, that's for sure. It's got to be a combination of phenomenon, some of which may be as simple as birds seen from a distance and misidentified, and other stuff that is must be truly, truly out of this world. If I can go into detail, because this does appear in Paranormal Mississippi River, so it is kosher, there's the name Harley Rutledge.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Professor Rutledge.
That's right.
Yep.
Who is shamefully not mentioned in a lot of extent popular UFO literature.
Cape Girardeau, Missouri?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, and Piedmont. What he did in 1973 during a UFO flap, got the backing, the financing from a local newspaper back when newspapers had money, and he had the opportunity to study UFOs in the field as the phenomenon was taking place. The flap there was going on pretty intensely for several months, with the occasional continued sightings of a daylight disk or an anomalous light in the sky for several years afterwards. Dr. Rutledge was able to corral astronomy clubs, fellow astrophysicists, reliable witnesses to see these things, and in the end, he published his. He photographed them with infrared film, examined them through a spectroscope, even had a Piper Cub pursuit plane if necessary. His fatal flaw, unfortunately, he called his operation Project Identification. By the end of it, he couldn't identify what was going on. He couldn't tell you what these things were, but what he could tell you was that they were there, they were happening, and a scientific, verifiable scientific scrutiny of them could not just dismiss them wholly as just a misinterpretation of the stars or the planet Venus or swamp gas.
I interviewed him back in 1982, if I remember that.
Oh, that must have been a privilege.
Yeah, and we were talking about the big story, of course, of the crashed saucer that happened in 1943, four years before Roswell.
I have that story too. Yes, something that you talk about, Charles Fort's, these are the damned, these are the excluded. A lot of UFO researchers do not want to talk about that story because it sort of eliminates their timeline, deviates from the idea that the visitors, if you believe in the extraterrestrial theory, took little notice of us until we exploded the atom bomb. Yet this allegation exists that a craft from outer space grounded itself near the Mississippi River in Missouri, and that FDR had the pieces in his basement. And, fantastic stuff.
I mean, Rutledge was a great guy. He was a doctor, a PhD type in physics. And a staunch believer in all of this. I mean, he did. Yes. He was very thorough.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And not afraid to admit that he did not have all the answers. He did not have one theory that he could apply to it. He was identified with the Earthlight theory, the idea that many the UFO sightings are the result of a sort of electrical plasma formed when crystals underground on earthquake faults like the New Madrid fault down in that area. It squeezed together, creates a jet or a plasma of, I suppose, ball lightning would be a good analogy. But even that's been oversold, and people attempt to account for every manifestation of UFOs through that. He did one great, I think, thought experiment in his books. He took the hoariest pulp fiction theory that UFOs are being piloted by escaped Nazis from World War II who have a base in Antarctica, and he said, okay, let's look at that. How much of the phenomenon does that explanation actually satisfy? And quite a bit of it, really. As opposed to the idea that these things are aliens who are coming from vast distances, light years away, and not announcing themselves, just coming and going furtively. The Antarctic Nazis could explain why they're on the run. They have a price on their heads. That's why they don't land on the White House lawn. Rutledge said they wouldn't need a very large fleet to cause worldwide sightings. For all we know, Kenneth Arnold saw the entire fleet at one glance, and his point was, though, that not necessarily that UFOs, flying saucers, what you want to call them, are Nazis with a base in Antarctica, just that you have to open up your mind and accept the likeliest explanation, even if it is sometimes the strangest. And I think that's a very good lesson to approach when the field of ufology. I think of ufology as being almost where alchemy was in the medieval time days. Alchemy, of course, later became chemistry and physics, but originally it was trying to turn lead into gold for the king, and maybe growing your own human being in a vat, your own personal homunculus, and we can laugh at it now. I would like to think that hundreds of years from now we'll have some incredible scientific knowledge that we can say that grew out of those outcast scientists and those gifted amateurs who were chasing UFOs in the 20th century. Who would have thought that they would have stumbled across this?
Did you hear those latest two stories, too, that scientists believe that there is a planet, an ancient planet, within our planet, that during a collision, they think the real Earth got it engulfed, and so it's inside. Incredible story. And then they found a huge ocean down in the mantle. I mean, two incredible stories, Charles.
Yeah, that first one, though, does sound like a Doctor Who episode I saw once, but... amazing. No, I had not heard that tale. That would quite possibly explain a lot. And again, open up your mind and see what happens. See what fits the paradigm.
In the paranormal books, did you ever come across the story of the hitchhiker woman? And, you know, you let her off outside of a cemetery and she kind of like disappears.
Oh, yes. That's another classic. That's the vanishing hitchhiker reported across the country, possibly around the world. Did I nail her down to a specific locality? No, not in this series. I would love to trace down where she actually might have begun. I think the origin of that story, I believe, was traced to ancient Rome, in fact, a ghost story told by I will pull the name Pliny the Elder out of the ether, but it goes back that far, the folk motif. But yes, I've run across similar things. The classic in the Ohio area is the Crybaby Bridge. Again, a sort of an iteration of La Llorona, where there's a bridge in town that supposedly either there was a horrible accident and the whole family went over into the water, or a young mother, for some horrible reason, deliberately drowned her children off it, and now you can still go out and hear her wailing. You may be able to hear the kids screaming. Someone, I think, did an accounting and found 90 of those in the state of Ohio alone. And you can just imagine how many there are nationwide.
Why do people like to be frightened, Charles? Because they do. They like to go to scary movies. They like scary stories. They like to be frightened. Why?
Sometimes I don't know, especially since the tail end of my movie reviewing career, my most active one, coincided with the rise of this stuff called torture porn. And while some of the Saw movies were quite diverting, after a while I just had to say, why does anyone want to see this? But a good frightening, scary story, it's not for nothing that they're called thrillers. They do get your adrenaline going. Perhaps they're a way to face your darkest fears. They're also a fine way to operate and maneuver inside the realm of fantasy. Lay on the overlay of true fear and shock, and from a box office perspective, you'll get the teenage market for sure. But I think, and it all again returns to the sense of wonder in a way, even if it's wonder at something horrible, you still just wonder. I have to ask yourself, what's the enigma of the moving coffins or Barbados, for example,
right,
which is neither in the Great Lakes or the Mississippi, but it's the ultimate locked room mystery. And your mind can't help but go to what happened in there.
Charles, let me ask you, too, as a film critic, I got to ask you this. I just saw an old clip of an old John Wayne movie. And, you know, he was in the Civil War. He was doing his thing. Those movies would never make it today. Ever make it today. How did things change like that? I mean, they did these war movies. movies. And, you know, they did John Wayne as a Civil War person and stuff like that. I mean, they would be flops today. Nobody would go to them.
Well, I don't quite understand. In which way would they not? You mean there wasn't sufficient action or insufficient?
Well, it's just that the, you know, now we're in the vampires and high technology and Star Wars and computer graphics. Those old type of movies, if they were made today, just wouldn't make it at the box office.
A lot of them wouldn't, very sadly. I think a number of them would, actually. I happened to just see a few these last few weeks. But, yeah, the old Hollywood classics, I would like to say a lot of them were intended for, let's shall we say, more mature attention spans.
Yeah.
But I think really, given a chance and given especially the ballyhoo and the website and the tie-in songs, I still think a lot of those oldies would hold up. And every once in a while in repertory, one or two of them are rediscovered and re-released.
You won't get kids going to them. They would never go.
If you can tempt them or something. I heard a wonderful story locally of some young teenager who went to see Rebel Without a Cause, mainly to see the Cars. He was just fascinated by the Cars, ended up falling in love with the whole movie.
The whole concept.
Being a born-again James Dean fan, and Natalie Wood and Sal Mineo and all that. The thing is, the movie industry has become such a high-stakes gamble. Every film costs so much to make. It's really gone to the lowest common denominator, and it's based on, it has to be a formula based on a comic book with the hottest star in it, because with a $250 million budget, there cannot afford to be any mistakes. And with if you have no mistakes, you also tend to have no originality, no room for experimentation. I would wager those old John Wayne films you mentioned are a lot more interesting than most people would think. I got one off.
They are interesting. I mean, I like them. But, you know, even with comedians, Charles, Jack Benny, Jimmy Durante, you know, those older comedians, they would never make it today. Kids wouldn't go see them. As priceless as they were in their day. You know, kids aren't going to go see somebody like that.
Probably not, but in terms of just pure cultural relativism, a lot of those guys were of their time. For their time, they were the Jim Carreys. They were the Zach Galifianakis's.
Yeah.
And, you go far back enough, you get to people saying that awful Charlie Chaplin. Look at what is our society come to that young people are going to see that Chaplin man and laughing at him. So I don't think they can quite be written off. One of my publishers was in fact for a website that was directed at parents and families, and they made it into a sort of a social media thing where young kids could comment on the films they were seeing, and they were into Buster Keaton. They, of course, who couldn't be? The guy's nonstop action, and Jackie Chan is one of his admirers. But I find that, yes, if once you can sit today's young audiences down, tie them up if necessary, and make them watch some of the classics, you'll be surprised how much they appreciate them.
We're going to come back and take phone calls, stories about myths and folklore and questions next.